Without a healthy mind, being truly happy and at peace is hard. The good news is therapy works. But what is therapy exactly? It's whatever you want it to be. Maybe you're not feeling motivated right now and would like some tools to help. Or maybe you're feeling insecure in relationships or at work, not dealing well with stress. Whatever you need, it's time to stop being ashamed of normal human struggles and start feeling better because you deserve to be happy. And now you don't have to worry about finding an in-person therapist near you to help. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Join the millions of people who are seeing what online therapy is really about. It's always a good time to invest in yourself because you are your greatest asset. And a special offer to I'ma Let You Finish listeners, you can get 10% off your first month of professional therapy at betterhelp.com/I'ma Let You, I'mmaletu. That's betterhelp.com/I'ma Let You, I'mmaletu. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring this podcast.
What's up, everybody? It's I'ma Let You Finish, show number 120. And we have a guest with us today. It's Court and Amy. Oh, and today we have RJ Smith, a writer who has worked at The Village Voice that I need to talk all about. He's the biographer of the new Chuck Berry biography. He's written a history about the definitive era in Black music in the 40s in Los Angeles. So many things. And he wrote for LA Weekly. We need to get into all of these things.
And the James Brown, I love your James Brown book.
Awesome.
I really do. And I have your Robert Frank book, but I haven't read it yet.
That's all right. That's the one to savor down the road.
Okay, good. I feel less more bad. RJ, it's very nice to meet you. Long time caller, first time listener, me, yeah, with you. Uh-huh. I have read your work for years. We have written for a lot of the same publications, except you've done it a lot better than I have. So kudos to you. Let's talk about The Village Voice for a second. That's the quintessential. When I wrote for The Voice, I felt like a real writer. I'm finally a real writer.
You know, I visited The Voice from when I was in college. We got a car trip together and we went to New York and I saw Max's Kansas City and I walked into The Voice and I just introduced myself to Robert Christgau, which was like, I'm still in therapy about that. And And then like a year later or so, I was starting to write for The Voice, and you could walk down that hallway, you know, and you'd see Stanley Crouch and Gary Giddens and Nat Hentoff. And I just tried to shut my mouth and listen to what everybody else was saying. It was just an amazing time.
What years were you there?
That was like 81 to about 90.
Oh, wow. So you were there like in the when they were on Cooper Union around there?
Yeah, that's Union Square. Yeah.
Union Square. All right. Yeah.
Can I just say, like, for a New Yorker of a certain age and a certain generation, like The Village Voice was like the Bible to me. I was so young in those days and I discovered so much through The Voice, and I always knew the newsstand because, you know, certain newsstands got it really early.
Astor Place always
like
got it early.
Tuesday evening because it came out on Wednesdays. Right. And I knew where to go before I got back on the train to go home to Queens. Yeah. And I was like, it was like the hunt. I have to have my Village Voice. And I read it on the train home. And just
how many jobs or apartments did you get from The Voice, Courtney? How many jobs or apartments?
No, well, none, because I also worked at Tower, but that's how I knew when everybody was coming to town, because And what movies to go see, like when we would go to the Angelica and all of the small art house films, because all of those films would be in the Voice. They had that great film section. And then in the back, you know, where all of the bands were coming, they had all of that in there. So it was just Mercury Lounge shows and all of the good stuff.
I got my first apartment in Brooklyn through the Voice.
Oh, there's so many bands. So many bands that advertise in the back, you know. Yeah. All that stuff. And meanwhile, inside that building, you know, it was this era of like every day there was a new coalition forming and a new feud breaking out. You know, it was the culture brats versus the city reporters. It was the men versus the women. You know, every week I was in a different camp. It was very confusing to me, you know, but and it was a time when you got just the most amazing hardcore rectal edit. I mean, you brought in a piece, and I remember one of the first pieces I brought in, Chris Gow was going through it line by line out loud. It was theater. And he said something. And I said, well, I thought, you know, well, I did it that way, but I thought you would help me make it better. And he just looked at me like, that's not how it works here, son. you've got to bring it in ready. And then we'll see what we can do to make it better. But it was an amazing time.
What do you remember what one of your first music pieces was for them?
I'll tell you what, I reviewed, early on, I reviewed a new Lou Reed album, maybe The Blue Mask, I forget.
Oh, I love that record.
And I made a point, I wanted to, I guess I was trying to establish myself in a way. And so I kind of like looked at it and kind of took a few shots at Lou around along the way. And Chris Gow just looked at it and he said, RJ, listen, you're full of shit. You are really full of shit. And I see like Richard Goldstein's head pop up from his cubicle. Okay, I'm full of shit. I'm going to let you publish this, but I want you to know you're full of shit about this. And that was The Voice. I don't agree with you, but you know.
We're going to publish it anyway.
Yeah.
I remember, this has got just Chris Gow. We were both up for this. You probably were there too. They brought in every writer who had a pulse, this TV show in Minneapolis that Request Magazine was sort of working on. And so they flew us out there and blah, blah, blah. And I remember Chris Gow wanted to get home really quickly because he really missed his kid. And he looked at me and goes, don't you miss your kid? And I went, no, I'm on a per diem. I'm staying in a hotel and I can drink. I'm having a fucking blast. Yeah. But thanks for asking, Bob.
So I want to talk about the Great Black Way. What inspired that? How'd you come up with the idea? Were you listening to music and you were like, oh, this needs to be a book? What happened?
Yeah, you know, I mean, like when I lived in New York, if you wanted to read a book about 125th Street, there was a library shelf full of books. Oral histories, scrapbooks, so much material, not enough material, but a lot of material. The history, the lore. Come to LA, I'm here in the 90s, and I want to read that book about Central Avenue, which is roughly LA's 125th Street. And there wasn't a book at the time, not a single book, not an academic tome. There was some great oral histories being assembled. But so I just did that thing of deciding to write a book that I wanted to read. And, you know, it was the rare time in my life, so many times interviewing so many celebrities or politicos or whoever, where you really have to throw down and make a case to get people to talk to you as a reporter. But, you know, to knock on doors, you know, in South Central LA to find an old saxophone player or a comic, a filmmaker. These people have been waiting for somebody to ask them these questions for decades.
Wow. Yeah.
And so it was just the rare thing by and large where, like, you know, you got that grievous look of where have you been? What took you so long? But, you know, people were just spilling their stories out and it was just a wonderful experience.
There was no kind of resistance in terms of why you and why, or they would, you know.
I mean, clearly there was. And the more I talked to people, and if I came back a third and a fourth time, the stories got better every time. The trust got a little bit deeper maybe every time. Some of the stuff. So yeah, that's always the case. And I try to represent as an outsider who's interested and maybe knows some of the touchstones, but I'm also making it clear I'm looking for a guide to walk me down the street and so I don't get hit by traffic.
I think that's always like, I'm not comparing my career to you, but as somebody, a white person who wrote a lot about Black music, you have to really be careful of like, I respect the culture, but I'm not going to pretend this is my experience. And I think the danger people get into is they think that they're down just because they're hanging out with a bunch of artists, and it's like, I mean, that's why I've always, what I love about your books is that the respect is there, but you're not pretending to be something that you're not.
I think the older the older I get, the whiter I get. And I think that comes out when I'm approaching people. And the relationships change and the dynamic between interviewer and interviewee keeps changing and it's more complicated. It's a lot to navigate.
I want to read a quote. From, I'm not going to lie to you, RJ, I didn't finish the book. Because I am of the age where when I lie down and start reading 3 pages and I'm passed out and I don't ride the train. I never realized how much I rode on the train until lockdown.
Yep.
Right.
And then I was like, oh God, I did most of my reading on the train. So I don't ride the train as much. So I have, and if it hadn't been the fact that I got into this like fight with a student, I would have been able to finish it. But I want to read this line because this line just jumped out at me. Chuck Berry was an African-American astronaut on an extended solo flight to violate established practices in business, culture, social mores, and laws. He was putting everything on the line. It was confusing to those around him, and he doesn't seem to have tried to explain it, maybe not even to himself, but he was just getting comfortable. African-American astronaut.
No.
Go, please. Love it. Love it. And you're writing about Chuck Berry like right before he explodes, basically. Yeah. It's like right when Maybelline has come out, when he's done Maybelline, right?
Yeah. And, he was not a joiner. He was like a movement of one person. And I think not being a joiner was his strength and his weakness. Other things were his weakness and his strengths, too. But, he believed in stuff and he saw stuff and he wanted to bring people together and shake up lives, shake up his own life. He was not afraid. He took a lot. Well, as we know, he all kinds of ways he paid a price for stuff he didn't do. He didn't pay a price for some of the stuff he did do. It's all tied together.
Right. What way did you want to write about him? Because he's somebody, my only my exposure to him, obviously, is through the music. But the only time I've ever really seen him is in the Hail Hail Rock and Roll movie. And he does not come off nice in that movie. Do you know that movie, Courtney? It's what Taylor Hatcher.
I do know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He does not come off like a good kind of guy in that movie.
He's not a jolly. I mean, but what's cool is that you really see a lot of sides to him. You see Chuck demanding money for to stand in front of the camera. You see people telling stories about Chuck that are obviously true and that aren't edited out. About you see him coming to blows, almost coming to blows with Keith Richards, and so you get a great sense of the person as well as the musician. Why I wanted to do it, because that music isn't dead to me, and it's I wanted to see what makes it tick now. And I wanted to discuss him and to put him before a new audience of readers and listeners whose music that they love has been shaped by him, even if they don't know him. In a time when we're talking about all kinds of artists and creative people and looking at the trail they left behind that isn't so pleasant, we're talking about putting together the complicated picture on artists that interested me too. Finding a way to talk about Chuck Berry, in the age of Me Too, in the age of Black Lives Matter, to bring him to life in our time, it seemed worth doing.
Do you think that he, I mean, we're music people, so obviously we know his worth, but do you think the average person really knows his impact, knows that every time you hear a guitar riff, it's him?
I feel like he actually gets his due in the pantheon of music. You know, I think that people talk about him when they talk about the beginnings of rock and roll in a way where they just say his name because they feel like they know they're supposed to, but they don't really know. If you ask somebody to really dig into anything about him, I don't think people really know much about Chuck.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that his shadow that he created and the influence he's had on people is huge and ongoing, but it's also it's outlasted him in certain ways. And people don't know his story, and his story is not always pleasant or fun, and it doesn't always fit into a digestible rock star. You can talk about, not easily, but one can talk about all kinds of, you know, Elvis, say, or you know,
or Jerry Lee,
right? You can talk about him as a rock star, and he's forgiven for all kinds of things that there isn't room to forgive Chuck for. So he's kind
now
of
why Jerry, is that?
Well, Jerry Lee never put her in a car and drove her across state lines. He married
part
the girl.
Of his race, for sure.
Yeah. Oh yeah, but I'm saying he had the good sense to marry the girl before he did statutory rape. You know.
Oh goodness.
Yeah. Well.
The 50s were a wild fucking time. You could get away with a lot of shit. You really,
there was nobody to tell on it. Yeah.
You could get away with so, but people got married so young back then too, that it seems strange, but not always strange, even though in today's terms you think of it, it's super strange. And it was, but yeah, it's like, it's the interesting story of a legends that people really love, or people too. And when you dig in, you do find all the flaws and all. And that's why it's really good that you've written this book, because I do believe you have to learn about the foundations of everything and of Black music and rock and roll. He really is a very important player in that moment of time. And I think it's important to keep that legacy alive and for people to have a definitive book to go to that kind of gives you the warts and all story of someone, because the complete picture is what it is. You know what I mean? And I believe history should be told how it is, warts and all.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, and we talk about, if we talk about rock and roll, you know, you hear people say, I've heard people say, well, you know, gosh, Chuck was doing great. And then the rock and roll era came along and he just lost his way. And
he was the rock and roll era.
He was, exactly.
Wait a minute. Who are these asshats who are saying that? I mean, take a sip of coffee. Yeah. Sorry.
No, I mean, that's it. I mean, it's people, you know, and it's people who came to it through the Beatles or the Stones or Nirvana or MTV, by and large. All those things to some degree. But yeah, I mean, it wouldn't exist in its form, or hardly at all, I would argue, without Chuck more than anybody else, because
the riffs are. I mean, the rock and roll riff, if we were to think of like what a classic rock and roll riff is a Chuck Berry riff. I mean, it really is. It's a Bo Diddley riff or a Chuck Berry riff, and unfortunately, they could not copyright either one. You know, because in today's age, they would be getting sample. They would be, you know, somebody would have to pay them. But I mean, those first, what, three or four Stones records, those are Chuck Berry records, but with, you know, another guy singing or something like that.
Yeah,
and they had,
no doubt.
But they would cop to that, though. I mean, none of these guys would say, oh, no, we came up with this all on our own, right?
Well, I mean, in Britain, definitely, those guys were really pretty good at giving credit, you know, giving interviews and praising the man, you know, praising Little Richard. But it didn't, in a way, it almost made it worse for Chuck, I think, because he had a hard time feeling the love, feeling the praise from fans, from people like the Beatles. And he, at the end of the day, still he saw them take his music places that he couldn't take his music, places that weren't even open for him to go anymore, if they ever were. And he never got past that. So it made it complicated, and he made him kind of bitter going forward.
I mean, it's understandable, right? I mean, it's totally understandable. If you see somebody getting not just the credit, but the money, I mean, let's be, you know, blunt. I mean, for something that you did, but it's how do you prove you invented it? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And how many times, you know, even when the Beatles in interviews would say, well, we learned this from Chuck Berry and so and so and so and so. At the end of the day, the fans listen to the Beatles. They're not necessarily going back to Chuck Berry. You know, they're going to forward with the Hollies and the Rolling Stones and the Kinks.
Right.
What was his financial shape when he passed away? Did he die with money?
He did okay. He did way better than say Bo Diddley or, you know, Muddy Waters. He did way better. He didn't get nearly all of what he was supposed to get and should have got. He got better and sharper going forward after his first few years. But he was, in all ways, as a songwriter, as an artist, as a businessman, he was pretty smart. He was really smart as a businessman.
Oh, good.
Yeah, did he have his publishing? I mean, or did Chess have most of his publishing?
Over time, he got it back. He didn't have it at first. He didn't know the importance of it. They didn't want the artist to know the importance of it, of course.
Right.
And over time, he got William Krasilowski, who is the great lawyer from the 70s, who got him that money back as well as he could over time.
Is there an estate that controls the image and the publishing still? And
yeah, there's a son, there's a family, there's children. His wife, his widow, is still here, still alive, and so they're all part of the estate. You know, there's property that the estate owns.
Great.
Yeah.
So, is there unreleased stuff? Is there anything like where there's stuff that like has been in the vault forever and like will come out, or is it like one of those situations where they might take it and put somebody else, you know, like take like a from the grave kind of recording or something?
Wow. That would be awesome. I've never heard any good stories about
Brandy Carlile's really good with resurrecting careers. I've heard, I mean, she's discovered everybody. She's amazing. She's amazing. I never heard of Joni Mitchell until Brandy Carlile came along.
Right.
I mean, bless her heart. She's a saint. You know, one of the saddest things about Chuck Berry is, other than, you know, that he was a pervert and whatever, but big pish tish. The saddest thing is that there's a whole bunch of people who think that he's my ding-a-ling.
Oh my God. Well, that's where I come in. That's okay. See, right. This is, I was born in 59.
Me too. Okay. When's your birthday? When's your birthday?
May 20th.
May 15th.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Well, you know.
Right. And our mutual boyfriend Barney Hoskins is May 5th. Oh. Same year. Oh. That's why we all get along so good.
Very cool. Yeah. So I mean, I'm listening to AM radio in 72, and I'm hearing that song and giggling, you know? And barely knowing what my ding-a-ling is, let alone what Chuck Berry's ding-a-ling is.
Right.
This is a lot more interesting. And, you know, and then there was this movie before Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, a little bit later in the 70s, this like Golden Oldies tour movie, like a live documentary thing called Let the Good Times Roll. And Chuck is the headliner of I think Jerry Lee is on the bill and Fats Domino and some others. It's a pretty good movie. But I watched Chuck in that movie and it was like, wow, that's what rock and roll is. And I'm hearing, you know, the Bob Seger I was listening to on the radio or the watered down versions coming from the Rolling Stones or whatever. But there it was in its unabashed form. So it was a lot to process. I'm still processing it.
How did that song ever make it through, considering that? I mean, I know people are stupid, but I mean, not for nothing. The guy had been like jailed for statutory rape. There were all sorts of, even in pre-social media, and he's putting out a song about his pee-pee?
But that if makes- you think about it, back then, it wasn't as uptight as it is now. Now everything is like, oh my God, people clutch the pearls. back then, it was kind of like you got a lick. Listen, you watched the old Law and Order, so like season one, two, and three, and you're like,
oh my God.
You're like, what? I don't think you could portray like people like this right. anymore without people getting upset. And the shit that came out of their mouths, it was just kind of like, I just don't think NBC would be giving you this at 8 p.m. on a Thursday night.
Yeah, you couldn't slap the suspects the way they used to do back then.
I mean, all of the things. So it's just, it was a different time where, you know.
Yeah. I think like they got those seven words you can't say, but you know, ding-a-ling isn't one of them. And they hadn't planned for that contingency. And here's a whole song, and suddenly it's the number one song in the country. Chuck Berry's only number one record, and they didn't plan on that. So you know, Vernon Reid in the book he talks about it as a subversive act. You know, like that people liked it for that reason. It was naughty and embarrassing how joyful people could feel about that, maybe, but also that it was sort of like in the pre-punk rock era, it was a way of being outside boundaries or something. Just not very interesting boundaries.
Well, especially, I guess, if you take into context who he was. I mean, it it was in a lot of ways a kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, like, I know you know that I know, you know, and now I'm going to do a song about exactly what you think I am.
Yeah.
You know, and most people, I guess, you know, didn't. I just want to shift really fast to James Brown for a second, since you seem to have a theme of troubled geniuses. you'd seen James Brown perform before?
I had, yes.
Back in like how, when, when did
like,
you get to,
like in the 80s and
when he was kind of doing the Living in America kind of thing?
Yeah.
Did you get a chance to interview him at all? Or
No, never interviewed the man. Started the project after he'd passed. And it would be a very different book if I had tried to write it while he was still alive, I think. It would have been a much harder book to ever see the light of day.
That's a great book. I have you want to hear my James Brown story? It's really good.
Of course.
Okay, I'll tell it anyway. All right, so I'm a young punk rocker, and he's playing San Francisco. He's going to be playing San Quentin Prison.
Oh.
Which, you know, it's in. Yeah, exactly. And so I don't know how I got invited to go, but I go to the press conference and he sees me there. And I bring my copy of the King Heroin record because, of course, I do. And he puts his arm around me and he says, "Youth are the future of America." And then I get invited to the show and we weren't allowed to. We were told don't wear any makeup. Don't wear blue jeans. Look as physically unattractive as humanly possible.
Really?
Because we were women going into a maximum security prison and we couldn't wear jeans, you know, because God forbid I find like a jailhouse husband or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, no makeup, nothing tight, nothing, whatever. But anyway, we go there and I have to tell you, it was one of the most surreal experiences of my life because the show was all black and Hispanic. And as we walked in, white inmates were screaming at us, lover. And there were guards, like they were literally like playing to a captive. There were guys with like AR, whatever rifles were patrolling the top of the thing. It was a phenomenal show.
Oh,
it was phenomenal. And he had the women coming out, but it was like, seriously, like the first and only time I've been to a prison, and I started with San Quentin.
And you didn't come out with a date? I mean, listen.
I know.
A little attempted murder never killed anybody.
I know, but Courtney, they branded me an in lover before I got there. So that wiped out half of my potential dating. And you know, plus I had a boyfriend, Courtney.
Okay.
I had a boyfriend back then. Okay, no, but it was just a phenomenal show. But he was another one that was like a piece of work.
Yeah. And they're super different. I mean, like, you know, everybody that I talked to that was ever in an elevator, right, with James Brown, you got out of that elevator and you had a story to tell from that 5 minutes you shared. But you could be in a band with Chuck for 5 years and not have a story that you could tell or would tell because you just didn't feel necessarily like you knew the guy. If he didn't want to show himself to you, he never did. So he was much more private and, yeah, so very different people, but
Do you think do you know why? Do you have any insight as to, because there is, it's funny you say that, because there is, and I think this is getting back to what Courtney was saying about the recognition. There's no persona. I mean, the only persona or image we have of Chuck Berry is him doing the duck walk, right? I mean,
I always think about is how he looks. His image is really based on his hair, the guitar, and how he looks versus any sort of personality, or even when you think about music, right? There's not that definitive album that people talk about when they talk about Chuck Berry. You can go through a lot of artists.
Or his voice.
And you go through a
period. I don't even know what he sounds like talking.
He really does
like,
seem like a giant mystery for someone who's very big, has a big part in the role of the beginning of rock and roll and rockabilly and all of these things. He still is like a mystery, which is why it's amazing that you've written this book, because that here are some answers to some of this, because I do believe that he is someone that most people still don't know. They know who he is. You hear the name. Of course you know the name.
Right.
Me, who knows so much about music, if you ask me anything about Chuck Berry, I'm kind of like,
Me neither. I know the hair, I know the mustache, and I know the look. I know the whole kind of look, and that's it. And the music, obviously, but I know nothing about him in terms of, I mean, other than the scandal stuff. But
I love to hear that he was smart and that he did not die broke, because a lot of artists from that generation were ripped off, didn't own their music. And I love to hear that some of these pioneers absolutely understood business early on. It's like you look at the Stevie Wonders of the world, like he understood business when he became an
Curtis
adult early
Mayfield
on,
you know, people like that.
I think of somebody, and I think about a lot of black comedians like Flip Wilson died a wealthy man still living in Malibu, you know what I mean?
He owned his
show and those things, he business, you know what I mean? So I love to hear the stories of people who, you know, have complicated lives. But the money part always comes in with a lot of these folks, and then their end is always so tragic. So it's great to hear that there is an estate and the estate owns property, and that means they're managing it, and you never hear about them. I hate to hear about estate fighting shit. I'm like the Prince estate. I'm like, get it together.
Yeah.
Get it together. Get it together. None of you had any money. And my thing is, none of you had a fucking dime. So get it together. There's no need for everyone to be fighting, thinking I should get it the fuck together.
You know, speaking of the Prince.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was just going to say, you're making me think, I mean, Chuck, of course, you know, Chuck had this thing called Berry Park. And it's like Perry, it's like it was the original Paisley Park in a way. Mm-hmm. He wanted it was like a country club. It was going to be like an amusement park. It was a place for picnics, interracial, you know, it was in the late 50s. He bought acres in rural Missouri, and it was going to be a place for all folks to hear shows and to have picnics and whatnot. It was for creative types to come together and record. There was a recording studio.
Wow.
So he was like doing this thing that Prince picked up on and did much better for lots of reasons, I think. You know, but he had this vision, and he had some money to make the vision happen. He opened a club in St. Louis in the mid to late 50s, in the late 50s, the rare integrated club in St. Louis, maybe the second one going on in like 58, 59. Both these things get shut down by the law, also because Chuck was in prison shortly after that. So, he had these great ideas and the money to make them happen. And that's part of the story too, is the hard facts of how white America treated him.
I think I wonder now, we were talking about what Courtney was saying in terms of not really knowing who he was. And yet maybe in a way, keeping people distance from you is a way to protect your legacy and protect your money and make sure it's like, I'm the performer, but you're not going to get to know me, because then you could exploit me, you know, like I'm just going to keep it like, you know, keep them separated, the performer and the person, you know, I mean, or maybe I'm giving him, you know, it's a way of reading it.
I have worked with performers that, you know, they absolutely have the front facing, who you guys all see, and everybody is projected all kinds of personalities onto, and then the real person. And it's like, if you become super famous, you almost have to have a parallel lives, the one that's kind of over here, and you're dealing with your family and all of those things. Then you go to work and you put on your work thing, right? And that means sometimes not getting as close to people that you may have worked with for years. There are people work people for years and they're like, I don't really know them, because it's always a professional relationship. I have no problem with that either. You know, it's no problem.
But he had to
came
protect.
To work. Well, there was a lot of things he had to protect, right?
Because that's what I'm saying. He's a black man, in the Midwest, who's got a who's already on the radar of Law and Order because of his predilection for girls. You know, mind you, rock guys are doing the same thing.
Right.
But he just, you know, literally got nailed doing it, you know, and that's why he went to jail, right? Was for the violating the Mann Act.
It's a complicated story, but yes, he went to jail for violating this law that's still on the books, a federal law. It basically what it said was, if you cross state lines, it targeted black men who were with white women in hotel rooms or in bedrooms across state lines.
That's so specific.
And the law literally says that the crime is if you cross state lines for immoral purposes, quote unquote. You know, it can't even spill the beans on what that would really mean.
So, like, basically, if I'm dating a black guy and we drove to Jersey, he could get picked up.
Yep, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. Note to self.
So what he didn't go to prison for was for picking up a 14-year-old Native American girl and having sex with her, promising her a job in his nightclub in St. Louis in the late 50s, getting tired of her when they got to St. Louis and buying her a bus ticket and saying, see you later. That's the part that is also part of the story. Right. So victim and victimizer.
But that's so weird. So, I mean, it was because she was 14. It was because she was underage, or because she wasn't black, because he was black and she was not black. The law, I'm just curious. The law, I always thought the law is like, if just bringing a minor across state lines. For
sex. But I don't think he was saying that this is related to that story. I think these are two different stories.
So like the law just says, crossing the state lines with a man and a woman for immoral acts, and if there's some money involved, that helps. It helps prosecute. But the fact that she was a minor, they didn't treat her in court like the victim. And she was, in fact, put in an institution during the course of the trial while Chuck was on bail. So she was in prison. She was in behind a wall while Chuck was still in freedom. And the first judge didn't know how to handle the trial, because he looked at her and he saw this Native American girl and he was just like, well, he literally all but says, I don't care about that. But what I care about is this black man who's clearly a bad guy. So let's just focus on that.
What did it do to his career? I mean, it just stopped it short at that point.
Yeah, it stopped it short, and he's in prison for a 3-year sentence. He serves a year and a half. And in that time, you know, the Beach Boys come out with a song that's a total rewrite of a Chuck Berry song. I can only imagine he's working in the hospital, the prison hospital, and that maybe he turned the radio on and he hears a Beatles song, right? Or a Rolling Stone song or something. And what he must have thought, he wrote some of his best songs while he was in prison, and then they came out the next few years. But it stopped his career cold in a lot of ways.
You have a favorite song of it? I mean, that's like picking your favorite kid, which is why we should only have one kid each, so we don't have to worry about that. But do you have is there a song of his that really, if someone said the quintessential Chuck Berry song?
Well, I guess I'm kind of partial to this one called Let It Rock. It's just really simple. It's sort of a John Henry story. He's working on the railroad. For some reason, there's a teepee built on the railroad tracks. Just that's what it is. A train is coming. So there's something indigenous. There's something African American. This force is coming, and boom, here comes. The train is going to knock it all down.
Hey, he was really subversive when you think about it. I mean, Brown-Eyed Handsome Man is a super subversive song. And yeah. and what you point out in the book about when him saying, is it in Nadine where he says Southern diplomat when he actually really means Southern Democrat?
Yeah.
I mean, he snuck the stuff in there, you know.
He was speaking on various levels from the start, no question. And speaking in code to different audiences at the same time. He wants the largest possible audience. He's using references in the song "The Promised Land." You can pick up resonances of the civil rights movement in that song. Yeah, there's so much going on in those words that if you don't want to listen to it, you can just dig it as a great piece of rhythm and music. But the more you listen, the more you can hear.
Was he politically active at all in terms of like the civil rights movement or any of that? I mean, he's coming, you know, James Brown was like, you know, involved in some ways, obviously, Curtis Mayfield and Stevie Wonder. Was he active at all or voice any kind of political opinion at all?
In the lyrics, beneath the surface, there are definitely political opinions, but he wasn't a joiner. He never gave a statement about the civil rights movement. I don't know that he was even asked that much. I've never seen that question posed to him in interviews. But he was a capitalist, and he believed that opening his club, opening Berry Park, creating integration that way was the way forward that he could affect. And he left it at that. And so there's a gap between him and the next generation, whether it's Curtis Mayfield, you know. I'm told he felt really happy and said he was happy when Obama was elected. Of course, makes sense. But he didn't share his political opinions.
Okay. Court, we always do a thing where we, first off, is there, this sounds like so corny, but is there like a book in mind now that are you going to continue sort of in this vein or do you want to go into a sort of different avenue?
God,
not avenue. Wrong word. Avenue is the wrong word, but.
I mean, I want to keep writing. I got to pick the projects carefully nowadays because, you know, how many more am I going to get?
You'll get as many as you want for crying out loud.
Thank you. I'm so glad I'm here.
You really will. First off, did I mention that I'm like getting into fist fights online with students? You will get whatever you want, RJ, because you're a really good writer.
That's awesome.
Hush your bazoo.
All right.
There will be no false begging for attention on this show except from me and Courtney.
But I want to do something really different. Maybe not another biography, maybe another one, but just something really different that's challenging. I've thought about writing a novel. I don't know. What books do you think need to be written? Tell me something you want to read that you haven't seen.
About black music?
About anything. Nonfiction, though.
I would love to see, it just occurred to me, because every year I fight to get her in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, a Chaka Khan book would be killer.
Oh.
Yeah.
And if you write one, give me credit.
Well,
I noticed in the introduction you thanked every human being in the world that writes, except for me. But that's okay. It's all right because we didn't know each other. So next time.
Well, let's work on a Chaka Khan book together.
No, I think a Chaka Khan thing would be amazing. And she might, I just think because she's another one. I mean, I love her and every year, like Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I beg and beg and beg. But I think she's someone that is so present in our lives, but we know nothing about her either.
And I think she's very alive. It would be like, I don't want to fucking talk about me for some reason.
Well, there's that.
I have a feeling she would not be like, oh, yes, I want you to go back and dig it. Because there is a story there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure she's not like, yes, please, let's go dig all of that up.
Yeah. Well, that's why you have to make them unauthorized.
You remember what happened with David Ritz with Aretha, right? When he wrote first Aretha book. And sent it, and she was like, yeah, no, and they edited it out, and then he released his own version, and she never spoke it to him again because he was like, I want to tell the real story.
Yeah. That book didn't do very well. That's just...
No, it didn't, because you want to read it with the dish.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, you do want to read. I mean, it's a horrible thing to say, but when you read a book that's like a serious examination of someone's life and you're going, who did they fuck? Who did they fuck?
Or there's whole sections where
drugs,
you know.
What drugs were they doing? What drugs were they doing? Come on. I mean, let's get real.
The thing is, Aretha's story is just way. Messy. So there's so messy. Many. She wasn't trying to have that moment for real. No.
Yeah. They could do a whole book just on that funeral. Funeral alone would be a book.
I watched that 19-hour funeral. I saw everything. Ariana Grande in a cocktail dress.
Yeah,
what is happening?
Really? You know, how many more times can Al Sharpton insert himself into something? What kind of stuff are you listening to these days?
Oh, man, that's a great question. I've been listening to lots of kind of droning. you know, I'm still in that pandemic mode of looking for music to soothe and heal. And so for me, it's been a lot of like young people making drones and, you know, LSD sounding music that I don't know that they're really taking LSD, but just sort of modern psychedelic folk music. I think that's sort of that's a lot of what I'm listening to now.
Like who?
Oh gosh. Like the Powers Rollin duo. Who's that? You know, all the kids of John Fahey, all the stuff that John Fahey was doing influenced a lot of you. Maria Anderson. She's got a new record out. Really mellow guitar stuff. I love that stuff. I also love Wet Leg. I mean, Wet Leg is a
yeah. Yeah, that's a great record.
That was a good moment. Yeah. Do you have kids? Do you listen to your kids listen to?
I got an 18-year-old kid.
All right, so. Does she kind of like, dad, turn your shit down? I don't want to listen to it.
You know, for whatever reason, she never, ever does that. So I feel like, okay, that's the one good impact I'm having on my daughter is, you know, my words aren't sinking in at all, but my music is sinking in, and that's pretty cool.
That is good.
But if I want to turn her off something, like all I have to do is say, wow, that's really good.
Oh, yeah.
That's like, it's dead to me now, Dad. Thanks.
No, it's dead. No, my son, he's much older than your daughter, but I remember once when he still lived at home, he was playing something and I go in his room. I go, wow, this is really good. What is it? And he turned to me, goes, it's your job to know who this is.
Ooh, brutal. Jeez.
Yeah, he said, and when Cardi B came out, and I was like, critic, because he goes, okay, Mom, this is why no one is hiring you to write about hip-hop anymore, because nobody cares what Cardi B is saying. They sound, they like what Cardi B is. And when
this was an event this past weekend. It was an event. It was an event of epic proportions.
What?
Mylène Farmer released her 12th album in France.
RJ, you know who Mylène Farmer is? Do you know who she is?
No.
Just say yes. Just not yes. Oh, say yes.
Tell me all about it.
And she's amazing. And she's a French icon. Okay. And the album is fabulous and it's getting great reviews. And it's like half orchestral, half dark electronica. And she's really giving you ethereal vocals. And it's gorgeous.
Okay.
And, you know, she's fabulous. And I love Mylène. Don't come for Mylène.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm explaining.
Listen, you know how I like my women
pop. I know.
I like a high production vocal, a high production budget with a questionable vocal. If you've
That's
got questionable vocals but a lot of money, I am here for what
I
you
was,
can
I
give
I was
me.
Going to explain it to our friend RJ that part of the motivation is if you can actually really sing, Courtney, you know, he would really prefer a lot of more bells, more whistles.
Well, and the new Wise Blood album, and In the Darkness, Hearts Aglow.
Wise Blood.
Yeah, it's really, really, yes. really, 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 really.
I listened to that on the kids like the Wise Blood. I will say I listened to it. She's obviously listened to a lot of mid-career Joni Mitchell.
Yeah.
You think
vocally.
So?
Yeah, vocally, which I'm not mad at because why not? I started listening to the Stormzy record. I don't know if I want introspective singy Stormzy.
Really?
I don't know if I want my grime. I don't know if I want my grime
Listen,
guys to sing.
Everybody has their emotional moment where they have to calm. The pandemic did the kids in. Everybody first came out saying, let's dance because we've all been locked in. Now we've been a year from really feeling super locked in, and now everybody's back to depression.
It's like where's the killing and jailing? It's like sort of like, I don't know if I want like the soft and tender, you know, Fivio 5, you know? I mean, I kind of go to that. I don't know what I've been listening. I've just been listening to whatever. I've been really kind of just preoccupied with other sort of stuff. But I will
say
that.
Like the World Cup, the U.S., the match is on right now with the U.S.
Oh, the Iran World Cup.
Right now, still it's the U.S. 1 and Iran 0. Oh, and I've been listening to Irene Cara's first album. Anyone Can See. That first album, which was an R&B record, and it was a really good R&B record. We lost Irene this week, and I loved Irene Cara. Like, to me, she was one of those first young stars that I remember who did everything. She could dance, she could sing, she wrote, and I was obsessed with the movie Sparkle. I was obsessed with her as Coco in Fame. I loved her David Geffen album as well that was produced by Giorgio Moroder, even though she didn't get to write as much there. But, you know, and they took her in more of a pop direction. She just was a great vocalist who ran into a lot of really interesting troubles in the music industry and entertainment. And I don't think really got her due so much when she was alive.
She was so much a part of people's lives. That's the thing.
That when she died, you see how much people are talking about how inspirational
I will say, though, as someone who was working in, at the Baby Doll Lounge when Flashdance came out, it drove me nuts to have to hear that song over and over again because I'm like, this is not what working in a strip club is about. But no, you listen to the song. She was, and also the look. She just had such a great look.
Let me just tell you something. Gorgeous. The short bang with the long hair with a crimp in it is iconic.
It's iconic. It was great. Yeah. And I don't know what else I've been listening to. I haven't been listening to...
You should go back to Me Lynn, because you need to listen to the Babyface album. It's really good.
Okay. And I've heard the Isley Brother record is really good.
Yeah. That's It is. It's like, that's the thing. And Babyface, that production, he's got all that young female R&B singer singing on different tracks.
Oh, this is the record he's doing with Ella May and stuff like that.
But the production and the song, it's very Babyface.
I love him.
It's almost, he's here to remind you, it's like, this is what I do.
And I can be Babyface again anytime I want.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've just decided not to use my superpower. Oh, no, I unabashedly, unironically loved, as far as I was concerned, LaFace and Fly Time were as important, if not more important, than Sub Pop.
Case closed.
Yes.
Thank yes.
you. And on that note, thank you, RJ Smith, for coming.
Oh, my gosh.
Pick up RJ's book on Chuck Berry.
I do this every week. I hold up a book that nobody can see.
It's available everywhere. He's got a book on James Brown. Listen, guys.
You're our new best friend.
We need some justice for the masters, and we need to know more about Chuck Berry. So there's a book out right now that's going to give you everything you need. Fucking pick it up and read, people. And you know what it is, kids. You're listening to us every week on the Pantheon Podcast Network. We're here. We love you. We'll see you next week. Remember, follow us in all the places. You know the whole drill by now. Follow Pantheon Podcast for over a gazillion other shows that are on there that are just like us and music, just everything. We'll see you next week for show number 121. Later,
bye.
Kids.
Bye.
Bye.